Hello, and welcome to the sixth episode of the World Superbike Podcast. That's right, I've reached a new milestone in that it now takes two hands to keep track of how many shows I've done. This is being recorded on Tuesday, March 14th, 2006. This and all the previous episodes can be found on the WSBK Pod website at www.wsbkpod.com. or can be found in your favorite podcast directory. As always, this is Alan Fleming, and I'm going to be your host. Thank you for tuning into the show. Since there are a few weeks of downtime for the World Superbike series right now, this is going to be a short show. This is a good thing because the past few have stretched well beyond the half-hour mark I had originally set, and I think those have probably gone a little longer than they should have. In this abbreviated episode, I'm going to start out by covering my usual administrative news. There won't be a calendar section since I'm going to push out the second half of the March calendar into the next show. But I am going to take a moment to voice some opinion about the scheduling of the upcoming World Superbike official test sessions. After that bit of venting, I'm going to go on and try out two new segments for the show just to test the waters. First, I'm going to do a health update on the riders to show how they fared after the first two races. Then, once that's out of the way, I'm going to close the show out by trying a little technical talk about some of what has been happening with superbikes over the past few years. Okay, on to those administrative issues. Listeners have started to add pins to the Frapper map after my request a couple of shows ago, and I want to send out a special thanks to those of you who have done so. I know Frapper is kind of boring for a user, there's not much there other than some maps, but it's very interesting for someone like me who is hosting a podcast. For example, just from the people who have already added themselves to the map, I can see that the show has a significant international following. As a result, I need to stay on top of providing international units when talking about distances, weights, and temperatures, not to mention remembering the difference between Celsius and Kelvin, which is something I screwed up in episode number 4, but that's another issue. So thanks again to the folks who have been willing to stand up and proudly be counted as listeners to the show. Naturally, I would appreciate it if more of you can find some time to add a pin to the map so I can see where everyone is located. The direct URL is www.frappr.com/WSBKpod. www.frapper.com/WSBKpod. Or, if you can't remember that, you can always find the link to that webpage on the links page at the WSBK Pod website. One big change for the podcast is that I have finally gotten off my butt and set up a Skype account. I did this primarily so that I can start doing interviews, but this also creates another way to hear from you, the listener. If you'd like to give me some feedback, but would rather do so via voice than by email, you can now call me via Skype with the user ID WSBKpod. If you don't have Skype and are willing to make a long-distance phone call, you can call me at 303-800-4285 and leave me a voicemail that way. Email, Skype, or voicemail, I would really love to hear from you. Speaking of interviews, I am starting to put together a list of the people that I want to talk to. I wanted to do an interview for next week's show, but I'm having a hell of a time getting in touch with people. I need to build up a contact list of some sort for the primary managers in the motorcycle racing world so that requesting interviews isn't such a pain in the butt. Anyway, interviews will eventually start showing up on the program, so please hang in there a little longer. As with the rest of the show, any interviews I do will be strictly related to the World Superbike Series. This will limit the guests that I can have on the show, but I think that in the long run, it will add some more credibility to the podcast. Well, with all that out of the way, let's fire this thing up and start talking about superbikes. This is where I'd normally be doing the month's calendar update, but I'm pushing the coverage of the second half of the March dates off until the next show. However, I do want to take a quick moment to look ahead at what's coming up with the World Superbike Series over the rest of this month. March 27th through March 29th is the first official World Superbike test session. This one will be taking place at the Circuit de la Comunitat Valenciana de Ricardo Tormo in Valencia, Spain. I happen to be riding around in Spain about this time last year and can say that if the weather this year is the same as it was last year, it will be perfect for bike testing. This test will be particularly important for the teams because Valencia will also be the location of the next race, which will be taking place the weekend of April 23rd. As a result, this will give the teams a chance to not only get their bikes ready for the rest of the season, but also get some setup in advance of the upcoming race. The next important date to keep in mind will be April 12th through April 13th, when a shorter second official test will take place. This one will be at the Circuit Internazionale Santa Monica, out on the Adriatic coast at Misano, Italy. Even though this is only a two-day test, I'm sure the riders will enjoy it because they not only get in some additional test time, but they'll also get a chance to do a little R&R at the nearby Italian beaches before heading back up to Spain in a couple of weeks for the next race. Make no mistake about it, these tests will be very important. They're the first test, which will have all of the teams attending together, so we as fans will finally get a chance to accurately compare how things are going among the various teams. It will also give the teams some time to adjust the bikes based on what was learned at the first two races of the season. So it's all good, right? Well, let me take a moment here to inject some more strong opinion. What the f*** are these guys thinking scheduling the two official tests after the first two races of the year? In any series, you want the teams to have as much time to set up their bikes as possible. This is doubly true when you're forcing everyone to use the same spec tire. While I'm sure it brings about some bragging rights to be the first international race series to hold a race this year, it's also forcing the teams to start out the season unprepared. And that's dumb. The manufacturers often can't make new models of bikes available to the teams until after the first of the year. Then Pirelli has to finish their R&D cycle and build a metric buttload of new tires. Then the teams have to find places with decent weather to conduct their first private tests during the winter months. The result of all this is that probably half the paddock showed up for the first race of the season without ever having tested with the 2006 version of the Pirelli tires. Those teams that did get a crack at the tires, like Alstari Suzuki and the Xerox Ducati team, had a distinct advantage over those that didn't. Now I know that the weather at Phillip Island gets dicey as the calendar gets further into the Australian winter, and I know the temperature gets hotter in Qatar with each passing day of the year. I also know that both tracks host MotoGP and World Superbike races, and don't want to host those races too close together. Still, these are all just scheduling issues that have to be factored in, along with the practicality of letting the teams test before the green flag flies on the race series. Anyway, I think the real season won't officially get underway until the end of April. By then, all of the teams will have had a chance to adapt to the new rubber and to get their bikes dialed in. Hopefully, we will see some new faces running near the front when the bikes line up at Valencia for race number 3. And hopefully next year, the riders will get a chance to do their two test sessions before the first race of the year rather than after it. Alright, rant over. So I want to try out something new for this show, which is giving a health update. I'm hoping to do this one or two more times throughout the season. The reason I think that this is important is that so many times championships are dramatically changed when a rider is injured. I think it's also important to remember who is injured and who is healthy when reading the race and test results. I've seen some truly heroic rides by racers who probably shouldn't have been on the bike. I've also seen some cases where a seemingly minor injury takes a rider out of the championship. So here goes. Please drop me a line if you think this is useful or interesting.
Look! Just a flesh wound.
Let's start out with the biggest name to visit the Med Shack lately, Alstari Suzuki's Troy Korser. Troy had an ugly high side during the second race at Phillip Island. While there has been no report of any injuries other than just bruises from this accident, this is pretty miraculous because he took a pretty good shot to the helmet, back, and left shoulder when he was tagged by Alex Barros. Riders, especially frontrunners, have a habit of understating injuries, but let's hope that this isn't the case with Korser. Even if he doesn't have any physical injuries, I suspect that he's woken up in a cold sweat at least once in the past week having had a nightmare involving a Honda CBR front wheel barreling straight down on his head. Also among the factory riders to have experienced a nasty high side at Phillip Island was Xerox Ducati rider Lorenzo Lanzi. He actually first hurt his right knee and ankle from a crash at the first race of the year at Qatar. He then got flicked off his bike during race 2 at Phillip Island while playing a new game called Bowling for Muggeridge. Despite getting a perfect strike on the Honda rider, Lanzi also aggravated his knee injury. I'm sure he'll get a lot of benefit from having 6 weeks until the next race, so long as he can stay on board his bike at the Valencia and Misano tests. To hear that Ruben Chaus is injured probably doesn't surprise anyone. He actually got hurt before the season even started. One surefire way to get revenge on all the people that are going to claim you'll crash away your return season to World Superbike is to get the jump on them by crashing before the season even gets started. Anyway, Ruben was training on his motocross bike over the winter and augured it into the ground, breaking his left ankle. He is still recovering from that difficult injury, but still put in some respectable top 10 finishes at the last two races in Australia. A healthy Chaus is a fast Chaus, and having another 6 weeks to regrow some bone mass is going to be a good thing for him. Sadly, a fast Chaus is also often a crashing Chaus, so we'll have to see if he can stay healthy for the remainder of the season. In 2005, my hero Frankie Keeley started his season out with an injury at the second race of the year. Now, Keeley has broken his share of bones throughout his lengthy career, so it was really no surprise to see that he came back early last season and put in some fantastic rides despite the broken ankle. Still, that injury started him out on, excuse the pun, the wrong foot, and he struggled all year. Well, this year the Italian apparently decided to try it again, but to get an even earlier start by getting injured one race sooner. Frankie got pitched off his Honda during race 2 at Qatar and broke his left ring finger, as well as generally beating up the left side of his body. He raced at Phillip Island, but didn't have the endurance to deal with the injury throughout the race. He ran about half of both races inside the top 10, but then found a reverse gear on his CBR and went backwards as the laps progressed. The broken finger should heal quickly, so hopefully he will be at 100% by the Valencia race. Finally, series rookie Craig Jones. This young kid banged up his knee in a practice crash at the beginning of the Qatar weekend. He then proceeded to crash 3 more times during the next 7 days. Either he got a clue or his team threatened to beat him senseless if he destroyed another set of FP1 bodywork, so he managed to stay upright for the entirety of race 2 at Phillip Island. There haven't been any reports of additional injuries to the Brit despite his ragdoll imitations. Perhaps that is an advantage of riding and crashing the slowest bike in the paddock. Still, even if he didn't re-injure the knee, he definitely pranged his confidence. Knee injuries can be slow to heal, but eroding confidence in a superbike racer can be even slower to reverse. Let's hope he can stay on the bike at the upcoming test and get a little bit of that mental healing underway. Alright, so that's it from the medical wing. Let's hope all these guys are on the path to recovery and that no one else gets added to this list throughout the season. For my final segment today, let me move on to the virtual garage for a little bit of tech talk. So the topic for today's tech talk are going to be the pressurized forks that are being used. I think this is particularly interesting because of the problems that Noriyuki Haga had at the beginning of the year that have caused him to revert back to his 5-year-old forks off of his old R7. If you're not sure what pressurized forks are, they're actually really easy to spot. They're pretty common on all of the GP bikes as well as most of the world's superbikes. They look just like your average set of gold-colored, unobtainable Öhlins forks, except that they have a cylinder mounted behind the slider, sort of where the caliper would be. On the bikes I've seen, it's about probably 2 inches in diameter and maybe 8 or 10 inches long. So the deal with the pressurized forks is that Öhlins introduced them into the World Superbike world during the 2001 season. However, they didn't really get talked about much here in the U.S. until 2003, when Eric Bostrom had so much trouble getting them to work on his Kawasaki Superbike. So let me start out by saying two things. First, I'm not a suspension expert. I am at best a layman. Second of all, this kind of thing is really difficult to explain unless you have nice charts and graphs and exploded diagrams. So I'm going to try and describe it the best I can, but if none of this makes sense, you'll really need to go look at some drawings and see if it makes more sense that way. The general idea is that when a fork is compressed and the oil inside the cartridge, because pressurized forks have to be cartridge forks, the oil is being pushed through all the mysterious washer stacks that are used to control the rate of collapse of the fork, also known as compression damping. Then the oil has to go back through a separate circuit to refill the fork leg, and this is rebound damping. One possible way to visualize this is to take two plastic cups, fill one halfway with water, then drill two holes in the other cup. Slowly push the cup that has the holes in it down into the cup that has the water in it, and watch as the pressure pushes the water up through the holes and into the top cup. Then remove the top cup and watch as the water flows back out of the holes. Now imagine that one-way valves are put over each hole so that water comes in one hole and out the other. Then further imagine that the valves are made up by stacking thin shims over the hole, and these shims can be bent by water pressure to allow fluid to pass. The stiffer the shims, the more pressure required to bend them when pushing the top cup down into the water, and thus the more compression damping being offered to the fluid that is being moved. The speed at which this fluid transfer happens in a front fork is determined by the displacement of the tire, which is simply the size of the bump, the resistance offered by the shim stack responsible for compression damping, and the amount of pressure inside the fork. Before pressurized forks became the norm, this was just the atmospheric pressure at the altitude of the bike, give or take some variation depending on temperature and weather conditions. At such relatively low pressure, fast-moving fluids can begin to froth, which leads to a condition known as cavitation. You can watch this happen in our cup example as small air bubbles will form as the water is moving from the lower cup into the top cup. In a pressurized cartridge fork, the displaced oil is moved into a separate area which is kept under constant pressure by nitrogen. The nitrogen is separated from the oil by a piston or bladder so that the nitrogen isn't absorbed into the fluid. By keeping the oil under a constant pressure that is above atmospheric pressure, the small amounts of air inherent in the oil don't come out of suspension. The result is a fork that can work through its stroke at a much higher frequency without the damping action degrading, and that means better traction for the front tire. The downside is that the small size of the cartridge, even one inside what seems like a large 43mm fork, means that only a small amount of oil is displaced when the fork compresses. This means that the forks are particularly sensitive to even small adjustments. In the Ohlins, compression is handled in one fork and rebound in the other, presumably because it would be too difficult to do both in such a small space inside the cartridge. So this sensitivity probably accounts for why some riders, like Haga and Eric Bostrom, have had so much trouble getting the forks to work. It is also worth mentioning, before I sign off on this topic, that other manufacturers have made these decarbon-style forks. Showa, for example, has run them on both race and dirt bikes in the past few years. So that explains what they are and why they are important. The last thing I want to touch on is their applicability to street bikes. I think the answer here is that they will definitely make it to street bikes. In fact, I think it's just a matter of waiting for the price to drop. They are complex, even more complex than the cartridge forks that are currently on the top-of-the-line sport bikes. However, that rarely prevents parts from trickling down to street bikes. As the manufacturing costs drop, then the manufacturers themselves will eventually spec them for their bikes. Rear shocks with pressurized remote reservoirs have been available on bikes for nearly a decade now, so you can be sure the forks will follow. In fact, it could be argued that pressurized forks will be even more valuable on the street than they are on the track, since road surfaces are generally worse on surface streets than on racetracks, and these rough environments are where a fork's ability to deal with rapid displacement of fork oil is really tested. The downside to these forks is that maintaining them is going to be much more complex, and they will probably become, like top-of-the-line rear shocks, a component that is not serviceable by the average mechanic. So I hope this little foray into pressurized front forks was interesting. Let me know if it was too technical, too simple, too short, too long, or just plain too useless. Well, as I said, this was going to be a short show, but it ended up pushing 20 minutes. I hope you enjoyed it. Now it's time for me to sign off. As always, anyone wishing to send comments, suggestions, complaints, or just say hello can send me an email at wsbkpod@wsbkpod.com or Skype me at wsbkpod. Think peace. Alan. And now for the obligatory legalese. This podcast is not affiliated with the World Superbike Series. All trademarks on that series are held by FG Sports.